Hello everyone, and welcome all of you to Nikki Lahl Creative Presents of Industry Leaders, where today I'm joined by Rachel Simpson, who's a design lead at Google. Rachel, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today. So would you mind just quickly telling us briefly about yourself?
Sure. And before I do, thanks so much for having me, Nikki. I'm so happy to be here. It's such a pleasure, and these events are so lovely. I'm really excited to have the opportunity, so appreciate it. And I'd love to hear more about yourself as well. I think after the intro, I think I'm keen to hear more about the event, which I'm sure you're going to talk about, and all the folks who've been tuning in. Just quick context on myself. So I'm a UX designer. I've been at Google for coming up on 8 years now, so quite a long time. And I've worked on a number of projects there over the years, from different projects on the Chrome team, dealing with kids accounts, emerging markets, and identity, through to the search team, where I'm currently working on a new project around emerging markets, which we'll talk about today. I also briefly worked on Duo, which is the one-on-one video calling software. And before Google, I worked as a freelancer, and I worked at a couple of different design agencies as well. So I think that gives a little background on me. I'm from Canada originally, and I'm here in the UK. And before that, I was in Germany for a long time as well. So lots of weird and interesting stories to tell.
Yeah, which is great, which makes you very interesting to talk about all your different experiences, like living in different countries, which we'll get on to later. My first question for you is, at what point in your life did you decide that you wanted to become like a designer / creative?
Well, that's a good question. I think I always had a creative inclination, even when I was young, but I think the element of kind of technology came in when I was a teenager. And in general, I think it was quite, at least where I'm from, it was quite risky to go in a creative direction with your career. And it was often, I think, kind of, people didn't really have a sense of what you would do exactly for a living. And I think when I was probably 18, I decided I would go to university for industrial design. Actually, I studied industrial design, and that was a controversial decision, and I think people didn't really understand what that meant and what that would be. This was even before I think interaction design was a job that one could have. You know, back then there were digital design roles, but it wasn't quite the same industry that it is today. So yeah, I think it was a progressive decision. It happened sort of in my youth when I did a lot of, painting and drawing and graphic design type work, and then into my teens when I was nerding out, learning to code, learning HTML and CSS, and starting to build websites and that kind of thing. So
that's quite interesting. It wasn't something that naturally happened within your environment. You gravitated towards coding as a teenager, and then where did you study at university?
Oh, I studied in Vancouver. There's a university called Emily Carr, a University of Art and Design, with a very strong industrial design program. And they have quite a deep focus on user-centered methodology and research approaches that was really critical. I think they actually now have an interaction design program, but the roots of the interaction design program comes from that research approach and, working with people to understand how a physical product or a digital product might work better for them.
Yeah, that's great. And then at what point did you decide to relocate over to Germany?
That was right after, well, not right after I graduated. I graduated and was working at a small design agency in Vancouver, which is a wonderful, lovely agency that was actually acquired. But I was working there, and I actually got some advice from someone I worked with who, knew that I was interested in maybe working overseas or working these kinds of design agencies that were starting to take strategic design thinking kind of to the next level. And really encouraged me. So I think I was 20 or 21, and I took a long trip around Europe meeting with people. I was very, very lucky to be able to couch surf and vagabond across Europe to the people that I had some connections with from an exchange I had, and was able to get my first job in Munich at an agency that was called Lunar Design at the time. It's now called Fluid Design.
Okay, and that's quite interesting. So to start with, you left and you went couch surfing, and then you found the right design agency for you. Okay, and so you worked on a healthcare project at university that I saw. What's it like working in that sector?
Oh yeah, it's super fascinating. I can't really say that I have deep expertise in this space. I haven't really, in my career, done a lot of health-related work, though, you know, one or two projects with some of the agencies that I worked at. But I think it's quite an interesting space right now, and I have a number of friends and colleagues working on that. Dan Burke is doing some fantastic work around that space with Simple, which is a product in India that he's been developing. But I think there's a number of things. So one is that I think it's quite a challenging space to sort of break into for new startups and companies when you don't have sort of deep expertise already, because there are all of these complex legal and regulatory and privacy related concerns and considerations, on top of the fact that, you know, you have to build something that is safe for people. But at the same time, I think there are all sorts of incredible improvements being made around things like building habits and compliance. So I'm thinking about some work happening, a friend of mine named Gabriel, who's working in the space in the Bay Area, where they're looking at how to use behavioral changing psychology to help people be more compliant for medication around asthma or other chronic health conditions. So I think there's a lot of room in the space for some of the thinking and methodologies that are common in UX design to be applied to problems that, you know, people have been trying to solve for a long time. So yeah, I think in terms of room for growth and innovation, it's quite ripe in a way, though a tricky, like very tricky space.
Yeah, this sounds like a really like quite rewarding space to get involved in as well. What advice would you give to any juniors that are watching this at the moment that would like to get into UX design?
Oh, I have a lot of thoughts on this because I've been interviewing candidates for Google for many years now, for maybe 6 or 7 years. And I receive, you know, a lot of portfolios from folks, or we review portfolios internally. I've actually got an article I'll share with you that you can pass on as well about this, because I think there's a lot of advice about how to prepare your portfolio well, and I think that's very specific. But yeah, I think the first thing is to be both bold and also thoughtful in your communication with potential mentors or connections. So I think it's important not to be, you know, afraid, or not to feel like there isn't space for you or there isn't access, because there is, and there are many people in the industry who are extremely generous with their time and, you know, willingness to help people up. And I love that about the industry, and always have. I think the flip side of that is to be really thoughtful about how you approach people. So a lot of the folks who are very generous with their time have very limited time. And so, you know, taking the time, for example, to check the company website to see what the job openings are, and to be specific about your asks, and to be clear about what you need from that person. You know, not to be presumptuous, but it makes it easier to help you if you're really clear about what it is you need. So I think that's one piece of it. Yeah, I think that's about it. I've shared on Twitter a few different threads about with specific feedback about portfolios that is more detailed. But I think having a portfolio obviously feels like a really daunting task for folks, and, you know, it's not always clear what that needs to be. I think with UX, there's an advantage in that it can be quite concise. So I think having, you know, one or two deep case studies rather than a set of 10 projects is actually much more meaningful. When I'm hiring, I can get a better sense of how people solve problems, or, you know, how they creatively iterate through different interaction solutions, those kinds of things. I think that's the kind of thing I'm looking for when I hire. And so when I interview, and I think that's harder to show when you have a lot of different projects with less depth, because you obviously have to if you have many projects. So yeah, keeping it really kind of concise, but being sort of deeper on each of the projects and being clear kind of about what role you played in the project will make it a lot easier for folks to help you find the right role.
Yeah, there's so many great things that you just said there, Rachel. I mean, one thing I'd like to touch on is bold and thoughtful. So important. I think a lot of junior people don't realize sometimes, because I get people ask me questions all the time, and I love to help. I think most of us in the industry, we really like to help other people out where we can, but being really specific about what you need from that person, and anything, like you say, thoughtful with their time. So doing your research first, what can you find out yourself without, say, approaching you and asking what's already there, like the threads that you've done on Twitter and things like that. And I always say, like, almost like things work quite well in threes, I ask three specific questions. So rather than coming to you with a very vague question that's so broad, or hey Rachel, can you give me advice on how I can make it as a UX designer, it's like maybe just three very specific questions that they have that's not too taxing for you, but you can get back to that, those three questions, and then hopefully that will really help them. And I think being specific is quite important, and yeah, being very thoughtful for that person that you're reaching out to. But it is important, any juniors that are tuned in, to be brave, ask, because the worst thing that can happen is they may not be able to always reply, but you'll never know unless you actually reach out. And there is so much kindness in our industry. And also the point that you said about showing two projects, I always advise people when applying for jobs, it's about getting like your process and your ideas and how you think in there. Would you agree that's the number one thing you're looking at, is how does this person solve problems within their case studies rather than the final result that multiple people could have worked on?
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I think it depends a little bit on the role and the seniority of that role, or I know it's a bit different across different types of design. So for example, I think graphic design might have a different take on this, though I'm sure a couple case studies would be really helpful in seeing how problems are solved. But yeah, from a UX design perspective, there's quite a lot of breadth in the roles that I'm generally looking for. So things like, you know, having a good sense of how user research works, and maybe having first-hand experience conducting user research, understanding what methods, like that's a chunk of it. Then there's, you know, how to kind of work with product and build sort of a product strategy. That's another chunk of it. Thinking about, you know, what the actual UI problems are, and like what are the different possible solutions for those problems, seeing that kind of creative iteration through different approaches, and potentially how that iteration moved through different rounds of user testing. You know, thinking about implementation and the sort of the technical challenges that were navigated with engineering, and the eventual potential launch of that product, and the, you know, how one knew whether that launched product was successful or not. What is the impact of that? All of those pieces kind of need to be covered in a case study. So it takes quite a lot of time to evaluate that in depth. And so I think it's worth kind of investing in putting together one or two really clear process examples rather than having so much breadth. Yeah.
Okay, great. And do you have a preference regards to CVs, one-page CVs, or are you not too fast?
I'm very low-key about CVs. I care much more about the portfolio. I think a CV is useful if there's, you know, specific experience I'm looking for, or the company is looking for. Maybe there are projects in the CV that are relevant, or companies that are relevant to the type of problems that are going to come up in the role that one is hiring for. But yeah, I my sense is that short and sweet is probably the best, generally speaking.
Yeah, okay. But like mostly portfolios are what's the priority for you when you're looking for particular candidates. And along with like, so portfolio and technicality and skill set is one thing, but do you have something you look for in that individual as a person when you're hiring?
Oh yeah, sure. I think so from the Google perspective, there are a number of criteria that are really important. Things like autonomy, being able to kind of think for oneself and understand problems and kind of build a framework around those problems, like a logic in terms of how you think of them. Being comfortable pushing back against the status quo or whatever things we've done in the past or ways in which problems have been solved. I think that's quite important as well, especially when working with other disciplines. So things like working with engineering, you know, if you hear we can't do this, taking the time to understand the complexity of it and unpacking that problem, because maybe you'll find another path. I think egolessness is quite important as well. So this, I think, varies a lot depending on the company, right? There's egolessness is the wrong word, like a willingness to collaborate and like let go of ideas. I think at a big company like Google, it's very rare that you would ever ship anything that you entirely designed by yourself. You know, it's a much more collaborative process and it relies a lot on creating consistency across different groups of designers within different organizations. There's a lot of complexity to that. And it's also, I think, you know, that takes a lot of sort of maturity and emotional development. I think, you know, that process of throwing designers into a crit that some people experience in school, some people experience in their first design job, it's very challenging. And I think, you know, there's a lot of skill in being able to receive feedback and to see it in a kind of clear light. And that's something I look for as well.
Yeah, that's great. And we've covered juniors, but what advice would you give to middleweights? I always feel like middleweights are the ones that are almost left out of any of these kind of discussions for advice. What advice would you give to maybe middleweights and seniors that might be listening?
Yeah, sure. I think that's quite it's an interesting set of questions, I think. And it's hard to know, like, do I consider myself also a senior middleweight? Like my career might last 30 or 40 years even. So who knows where we are on the path, but I think there's something about when you kind of hit a certain level of seniority and you have to think about, you know, what is my long-term trajectory as a designer? Like, what are the areas that I want to invest in? Do I want to develop deep expertise in a certain area? Or, you know, right now I've kind of been going through the process of moving a bit more into mentorship and management and trying to understand what those skills look like. I think when you're sort of at a middling level, it's not always visible to you what you could, like where you could go, what paths you could take and how you could develop and what resources are available. So when I started managing a whole wealth of, I've done more than 20 different trainings in the last 2 years around just specific to sort of coaching and training and other kind of management related skills that, you know, I didn't have a good sense for the depth of that that learning that was possible. So yeah, I'm not sure what the advice is there exactly. I think except to be like to trust yourself and the areas that are of interest to you. I think when I started to push into managing a little bit more, I think people question it. I think people don't always want to. It's a bit of a transition, and I think it's a little bit almost a cost to the org in a way, because you're going from being an expert at something that you've done for many years to being a complete beginner at something that you've never done, and you're probably going to be bad at when you start it. And I think there's also the assumption that the only path for development as a designer is to become a manager, which is really untrue. I think there's so much there's so many great opportunities to become an incredibly deep individual contributor who leads the team in a way that's different than having people report to you. So I think, you know, you have to kind of trust your gut and know what you're interested in and then push in that direction, knowing that it might not be as clear a path as when you were a junior with an obvious straightforward route.
Yeah, that's a really good answer, actually, because I think you've just got to go with what appeals to you and what you gravitate towards as well as a designer and as a creative, and that direction can only come from yourself, and that's where your passion lies. I think that's what most people look for, is what are you passionate about? You know, how can you add value to an organization, and what excites you? And managing people, my goodness, that's a whole other skill altogether. But it really is. And such a talent as well, to be able to get the most out of individuals that work in your team and mentoring those and developing them and imparting with them as well. But like you said, you can have a really successful career if you choose not to go down that road and you just focus on yourself as a designer or a creative and perfecting your own craft and expertise and skills there as well. Let's go back a little bit when you were based in Germany and working there. And then how did you then decide, what was the story to then relocating to London?
Yeah, sure. So I worked in Germany. When I first moved, I was working at a small design agency, as I said. Then they're lovely. They had some wonderful projects. And when I finished my contract with them, it was about 8 months long. It was initially 1 month long. We just kept extending it and extending it. But when I finished, I wasn't quite ready to leave. And so I applied for a freelance permit, which took some time. I've never before in my life wrote a 30-page business plan in German. And in fact, I haven't really actually. All my friends helped me when I was there. But it's quite a process. So coming out of that, I spent about a year or a year and a half freelancing, so working with all these interesting companies in Munich. I worked with, for example, BMW and DriveNow to help them bring their electric vehicles into the to bring electric vehicles into their drive sharing program, which had previously had no electric vehicles in it. And I worked with a few startups. So there's a startup called Turtlebox, which does sustainable moving boxes, and I was worked with them to do all sorts of things for them, their brand, their website, all the user testing, everything they needed. And I worked with Freeletics briefly as well. They're an exercise app. When they were a tiny startup in a room at the university, and now they're a big thing in Germany. I worked with a bunch of different companies, and I was at a conference in Munich one day, and I met someone from Google who convinced me to apply. At the time I had a comfortable freelance business running, and I wasn't really looking to start a job at a big company, but I chatted with them. They were really interesting, and through the process I was really convinced that it would be a great opportunity. I was very lucky. I was brought onto the Chrome team. I didn't know which team I was interviewing for when I started talking to the company. In fact, actually the role I was initially interviewed for was filled, they asked me if I wanted to move, but I wasn't ready to. And very luckily, Glenn, who was the head of the Chrome team at the time, had been looking to start having designers outside of California. So I was the first designer hired on Chrome who wasn't based in California, 9 hours remote, working with teams in Munich. I was very lucky. He told me later that had been an experiment, and I'm glad that I had passed. They now have a large team in Munich, actually. I think at least 5 designers based out of that office, and more offices that have come online. So that's fantastic. I worked on Chrome for 5 years. It was quite a long commitment, and many wonderful projects over the years. And I probably would still be there, but I was really interested in a little team in London. I'd been chatting with the manager, Ben Davies, for some time, because I'd worked on emerging markets related projects for Chrome, and Ben had been involved in the emerging market space for years and years. And he let me know that he was looking for someone to work on their project, which is called Google Go. Regaled me with all the tales of interesting and exciting features that they're building, and all of the exciting research they were conducting on the ground in India and Indonesia and Nigeria and so on. My partner and I decided to move to London so that I could take a role on the Google Go team. My partner moved over as well. He had been running his own game design studio at that time, and they just launched a big game, and he was kind of looking for something new. So he also moved over here, and he's been working at DeepMind as a game designer for a couple of years now as well. So that's the whole story.
Amazing. And so what was it like when you were freelancing and managing your own clients?
Oh, I love managing clients. I think that's something that a lot of designers, I think, are quite anxious about, or I think it's hard to know, especially when you get started, how to kind of set those boundaries and, you know, draw clear lines around the kind of work that you do and what you can offer your clients. It's a really tricky process, because it's also kind of comes down to this core question of confidence in yourself as like a creative professional, where, you know, you come up and everyone's telling you how lucky you are to get to work in a creative space, and how I think there's always a deep understanding or appreciation of what it takes to be a creative person and, you know, work, not just enjoy, but really, you know, produce. And so I think we internalize that, and we don't feel comfortable charging our clients or being really clear with them about what is and isn't in the contract, or, you know, just being able to kind of sell to them the things that they need. But actually, if you can get comfortable doing all those things, they're really helpful. Clients really want to know what you can offer and how much it costs, and you know, want to understand if they invest more, what kinds of more exciting things you could do to help them sell their product or solve their problem or build their brand. So yeah, I think that's, I find it all really fascinating. I like kind of project managing stuff, and I like having a good clear contract, and being able to judge which clients are going to be the best investment of my time, those kinds of things. So yeah, I'm always happy to chat with folks about that.
Yeah, well, I think there'll be a few freelancers that will be listening to this for sure. It's really interesting what you said about like the client management side, because I know some creatives can really struggle with that. And how do you really manage your clients so that they work with you, so that you're actually helping to solve problems within their business? And I really like what you said, Rachel, about, okay, so if they spend more with you and they increase their budget, what more could they get? It's not about offering everything straight away, right? It's about setting boundaries of access to your time and your skills. And then if they pay more, what else do they get? And being quite clear with that, actually, so that it's a very fair and open process. And would you say like contracts were just an essential part for you, like getting that sorted straight away before taking on a booking?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I love that you mentioned that, because I think it's something that I still know designers who are afraid to, you know, ask the client for the deposit before they'll start their work. But I've definitely had cases where, you know, I'm sure a well-meaning client was waiting for the payment from somewhere else before they could pay my deposit, and promised, oh, they'll pay. And of course, if it didn't come through, which it didn't on their end, then they wouldn't have been able to pay. So being really clear about, you know, hey, I'm happy to start work, but you're a new client and I expect a deposit from new clients, I think is a perfectly normal business practice in every industry. The contract itself, so the caveat, I'm not a lawyer, I use a template. It's worthwhile investment to hire a lawyer to write your contract, or to use a template from any of the existing design associations. I would go through it when I had clients. I would go through it in person, like just walk through it with them and say like, hey, you know, here are each of the pieces. It would help us be clear about what the project was, like what they needed from me, and that I understood what they needed from me, and vice versa, right? Everything I need from them so that I can do my job, whether that's copy or assets or time for a workshop, right? Things like your kill fee, right? If they decide that they want to kill the project, what does that cost them? Because it should cost them if they kill the project after the contract is signed. And yeah, just all of those important details that make a client relationship healthy. Mike Montero gives a lot of good talks about this, and they're worth watching, even though his language is colorful.
Is that Mike Montero?
He's quite, sorry, go ahead.
No. I've actually got a talk coming up with someone that used to work at the AOI for many years, assisting illustrators, and has now moved to a new company where we're going to be giving advice. And obviously, as you said, Rachel, like not being a lawyer or solicitor, or I always say I'm not a financial advisor, but I can make suggestions about some good ideas, and then it's up to you to maybe invest in some proper legal advice for your contracts.
Yeah, but I want to reiterate, it's okay to not start working until the client signs the contract and they pay their deposit. I think that's just a really, that's so fundamental. And if you can do that, then that's the first step to a healthy freelance business.
Yeah, and I love the fact that you're saying that you always used to get your clients to pay a deposit up front, because lots of designers, they'll do all the work and then later down the line, the well-meaning client hasn't been paid an invoice, so they can't pay that designer. So don't be afraid to cost a project with a client and then ask for some payment up front, and always be mindful of clients that try to swerve that, because that's not a great sign of a working relationship if they're funny about paying you.
Yeah, that's pretty basic.
it is so basic, but you'd be surprised how many people just working projects, and it's like, yeah, be mindful of people that avoid the money talk, really. So then how did you find relocating over to London and settling in?
It was actually quite smooth. I think after living in Germany and like all of the complexity of that, it was much easier to move to the UK. And of course, I was moving with Google at the time, so things like visa, it was a little simpler. Whereas with Germany, I went through a number of different visas over time, so that was more involved. I think it's wonderful to be here. I think it's such a obviously it's a fantastic city to live in, you know, less so these days, but generally speaking. I think it gave me access to a lot of, projects, both at Google and I think a community that's extremely diverse in terms of the industry and the people that are here.
Mm. This is what I love about London is just the people that it's attracted over the years. Unfortunately, because of, I hate to say it, but Brexit, we're going to see a couple of changes, I think. Hopefully not too many, but it has definitely put a spanner in the works in some respects, to like the vibrant scene that London does have. But so I want to talk to you a bit more about Google. And could you tell us a bit about Google Go? Sounds quite exciting.
Sure, yeah, I'd love to. So Google Go is the version of the search app that we ship on Android Go devices. So Android Go devices are quite commonly the devices purchased by new internet users. So people who are coming online for the first time, they're fairly inexpensive devices. So we see that it's, you know, often the device selected. And especially in countries like India, Indonesia, Mexico, Brazil, Nigeria, for example, these emerging markets, and or other terms that one might use. We use a lot of different terms internally that are much more specific. And I think the phrase emerging markets is okay, but there's a lot of really interesting thinking around this mental model of developing versus emerging markets, or the normal markets, which I think is not really the right mental model. But anyway, all of that aside, I think Google Go is interesting and unique because it was developed from the ground up specifically for new internet users, using a process of iterative design research. So that team is invested very, very deeply in user-centered research methods, and we have a lot of resources to be able to run regular studies with whatever features that we're developing. Yeah, I think there are a few things that Google Go has been able to do that it's a bit different and a bit new. So things like investing very deeply in voice search and typed search that is targeted towards users who might be stuck working with the web in their second language. So most users in emerging markets, in particular in India, users are on devices that are set to English, but they might not be fully comfortable with an English language interface or content. So Google Go has this sort of very lightweight, quick, suggestive search experience that's a little different from the standard search that makes it easier to type in a query. Other features that are quite unique. So Google Go has something called karaoke mode, which allows the user to tap on a play button when they're on a website and just hear the website read out to them, which is quite nice to see the user testing for that feature, because people really react to that it really kind of makes it easier for them. They'll often say how nice it is to be able to listen to this thing while they're doing something else, like chores, for example. So that feature, I think, is quite unique and interesting. Yeah, besides that, another sort of key thing is that it's all in one place. So quite different from a lot of the approaches we've taken at Google, you know, which are more minimal and more reduced. Google Go is a bit more maximal. So there's a lot of icons on the home screen that show you what features are available. It's similar to you know, a number of the apps that you'll see in Southeast Asia that kind of have all the stuff right there. And we hear that again and again in the user research. You know, it's all in one place. Not just, you know, Google features, but links to websites as well, like Wikipedia, for example. So, you know, for users who haven't come online before on another device, they're really coming online for the first time on a mobile device, they might not have this mental model of the internet and, you know, all these websites and this www, like, they don't know all of those, that fundamental information, and they're just looking to, you know, answer a question or solve a problem. And so having all of those websites listed or all of the Google features listed helps them understand what's available and what kinds of things they might be able to do on this device.
It's really interesting, because a lot of us forget that we've had access to the internet for many years and we're very used to it. But for people that are just getting access for the first time, what's that experience like for them? You've also done some work for Doctors Without Borders. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Sure, yeah. That was some time ago, but it was a really wonderful project, and Google has maintained a relationship with them for some time through a program called Google Serve, which allows us on the employee side to volunteer for nonprofit organizations in a variety of ways. So my work with MSF, medicine, my French is brutal, Doctors Without Borders, they came in through the Google Serve program, and they were looking to solve a variety of kind of organizational challenges that they had, everything from, you know, their internal system for taking donations and managing their donors, through to other systems that they were wanting to tackle. And I think also some organizational questions that they wanted to be able to push on themselves. And at the time, I think I was I took this on, and I was really excited to work with them. They were really excited to work with me, and I was I saw that they were quite keen, and I pushed them quite hard to narrow their focus to a specific problem, to really be crisp about the types of growth they wanted to see. And I think that work was really meaningful. And it kind of culminated in a design sprint that I organized for them with a number of other folks at Google, where we specifically prototyped a number of different solutions for their donor management. And I think that was really impactful, not just because we could do that, but because actually doing that taught them that process and helped them, the folks from within MSF, push more within the organization towards maybe more modern approaches in their technical department. One of the engineers who joined the sprint has gone on to be, I'm so embarrassed, I'm going to forget his title at MSF, but he's leading the engineering team in New York, and has pushed them into much more sort of quick and iterative practices, which I think is quite innovative in the nonprofit space. So yeah, I think, and I should say, by the way, they went on the following year to do a design sprint with one of my colleagues, Bergen, who also worked on the Chrome team, and they've been, I think, just consistently trying to move their organization forward and look at new ways of approaching the problems that I think the whole nonprofit industry has always grappled with for some time. So yeah, I think I'm really happy about that work, and I'm really happy because I've heard from them how beneficial it was to kind of go through this process.
Yeah, that's amazing. And it's great that Google allows for that as well, that they'll have certain organizations where you can donate your time. to really helping them. And you can't have much better access than the team at Google, hey? Can you tell with your like infrastructures online? How have you seen that the pandemic has affected the digital landscape?
That's quite a, it's a very broad question, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think from my angle, I think the first thing that comes to mind is really about the way we're doing our work, which isn't the whole digital landscape, but it's kind of this funnel into which the digital landscape flows. So thinking about the way we're conducting user research, I think is really important, right? We used to be able to do user research in person and see people use our products. And we've had to find new ways to do that. On our team, we're working with, we found that the traditional ways of doing digital user research just didn't help us reach the users we wanted to reach, that, a desktop computer was a barrier. So we conduct a lot of our research via WhatsApp. So we recruit for pairs of participants. One of them is the participant and the other one's the videographer. And we send our prototype to them and then do the user research in this way. But I think that, we still need to kind of keep pushing and finding ways to do high quality user research in this new world that we're in. Because I think in a few years, if we don't, we'll see this impact on the digital landscape, that in this moment where all of these very traditional organizations like banks and the medical profession and insurance and just all of these big behemoth old-fashioned companies are moving online because they have to, and they're doing it at a time where it's harder than ever to do high quality user research. So it's a moment for all the designers and the engineers and the product managers and everyone who cares about user-centeredness to be really emphasizing that and be really thoughtful and really focused.
Definitely. And how have you personally maintained an element of motivation throughout the pandemic?
Ooh. Yeah.
That's a toughy question, I know, but I guess, yeah.
Yeah, it's a big topic, actually. In all of the different manager communities and designer communities, everyone I am connected to right now, that we're all talking about this. And I actually thought really for a long time about this question when you sent it over to me earlier today, because I think the first piece of it is acknowledging that it's okay to be less motivated. And I think that's, people say that and it seems trite, but it's really that, we're carrying this weight of uncertainty. All of these kinds of decisions that, in your life that you've made, right? I live in London and I work at Google, and all of these kinds of core fundamental things, the reasons why you made those decisions might be shifting, right? Maybe it's nicer to live in the countryside than it is to live in London right now. But, how long is all of this going on? All these questions, they create this weight of uncertainty that we all have to carry. And it's unprecedented in many of our lifetimes. I hate to use that word again, but yeah, so it's okay if you're less motivated, and it's okay if you can do less. And I know that sucks, but that's, I think, the case. And if we can all just kind of accept that and then let ourselves off the hook, then maybe we won't be carrying the extra weight of the guilt we feel for not doing as much as that we used to. Okay, sorry, that was a long rant, but I think
because I think it's really important for us to talk about these things and be really open and honest about it, because people look at an individual such as yourself, who's, a design lead at Google, and you're working all these amazing projects and doing all these great things, but saying, you as a human being are also going through a global pandemic of a deadly virus. We can't avoid that. We don't always want to be talking about the negatives, do we? But this is our situation. We have to embrace it. And I think that more than ever, I've been focused on like self-care and toolkits that I have. When I may feel stressed about, okay, Nikki, what do you like to do that makes you feel better? And actually having that toolkit available.
I love that, yeah.
And just, so I started something called, I really got into journaling and morning pages, because I'm someone that's always very mindful of not putting my feelings or emotions on other people that are going through stuff. So I find journaling a really amazing process for me, just filing my thoughts and working through them.
Yeah. I think there's another piece of it, which is about creating habits that help you feel balanced. There's a couple pieces of it. So I myself find that yoga and jogging, like getting a little bit of exercise, something every day, helps me kind of manage stress and feel good, all of those kinds of things. But I really, you know, I wasn't the kind of person in the past to do exercise, especially in the morning. But that's when I have time. And so I kind of started this practice years ago of, you know, I would just give myself, I would have to do something every day, but it was okay if it was just 5 minutes. So yeah. I started to do that, and that made it easier. I'm sure that's how you also started this practice of journaling, this just, you know, giving yourself a little task, but not something that feels overwhelming, and then kind of building into it over time.
Yeah, it needs to support you, not be something else in the to-do list. Yeah, you give yourself to work through. And are there any exciting projects for us to look out for in the future?
Yeah, let me think. There's so many things in it. I'm conscious of time. I think the one thing I would like to highlight is, well, there was recently some research that came out, I guess over the last couple of years, but a big chunk of it recently, around gender equity in product design. I think that's something that I think has been a really deep investment from Google over a period of, I think, 3 years before we released anything. And it's a gap. So thinking about emerging markets, it's definitely a gap. In some developed markets, it's also a gap. And looking for ways that our products can more explicitly include different genders, I think has been really exciting. So looking at that research and maybe some of the features coming out around it would be a good place to start.
Yeah, I agree with you. And everyone's talking about equity and not equality, and actually addressing the kind of systemic barriers as well that we have at the moment that we need to overcome. Definitely. So, and that's something that Google's been heavily invested in.
Yeah, for many years. I think, you know, there are many, many equity efforts, I should say, that I, you know, I can't speak to the whole spectrum of them. Though they're wonderful, and I think the investment is great. The work that I've been more explicitly involved in was around gender equity in emerging markets. And there's a lot of fantastic research that's come out from Garen Checkley, for example, looking at, you know, what that divide looks like and what the different causes are of it. And I think, you know, we'll need to kind of invest over time much more. There's some more intersectional research, I think, in progress, but that's not out yet, that will be really exciting as well.
Yeah, well, I'll certainly be checking that out and keeping it up. But Rachel, thank you so much for answering those questions. I'm going to skip into the Q&A section now, and feel free to ask away. So Matteo has asked a question regarding a UX UI case study. What contents a case study needs to include for you, and how detailed each section needs to be, i.e. research, plan, conceptualize, structure, design, analyze. I'm a UI UX designer and worked across all the stages of a design process, and most of the time I struggle creating a case study because I don't know how details, you know, each section needs to be.
It's a great question, Matteo. Thank you. And Nikki, I'll share with you a document about this, and maybe we can share it to folks afterwards, because I think it's hard to answer in enough detail in person, but I'll have a go. So I think what's important is it's a delicate balance, and it is really difficult. I want to acknowledge that it's hard to kind of cover all of the complexity and nuance of a given project in a very short and concise portfolio piece. And I think the first thing to do is kind of let yourself off the hook. You're not going to get everything about the project. And then it's mostly important to give people a clear picture of the project and the important parts of it. So I think at the beginning, understanding the briefing and the context around the briefing, as well as your role on the team, is quite important. You know, were you the one designer? Were there many designers? Did you have to work with designers on other parts of the company to, you know, connect and bring together the work that you've done? Then thinking about the foundational piece. So what research insights did you derive from, you know, whether you did desk research and looking at existing studies, whether you were involved in or conducted foundational research, or, you know, whatever kinds of inputs you had, whether qualitative or quantitative. And I'm not looking for something comprehensive here so much as I want to know that you are able to look at all of those comprehensive inputs and to find a conclusion to say, you know, I looked at all of this stuff and I think the real problem is this. I think this is going to, this useful bit is going to give us something to work with. From there, I think there's a piece around like defining the problem that I think people struggle with a bit. That might mean things like developing a persona based on the you know, segmentation or the user research that's been done. And so people really understand, you know, who are we designing this for? It might include technical inputs, right? We have access to this new technology. Like, honestly, we have access to this new technology and we wanted to see how it can best be fit into our new product. That does happen. And I think it's okay to be honest about that, even if you're dubious about it. And yeah, just framing, you know, we came in with this briefing and did we reframe the problem in some way based on what we learned about the space? Then I think there's a piece around exploring solutions. And often I kind of like treat that in my answer as like, well, like you explored solutions, but I think it is really important and meaningful to show that you are exploring a diverse breadth of creative ideas. You know, it is good as a designer to be able to say like, we needed this kind of UI. I pulled together the components we had and we made a list, right? Like whatever it was that you solved for. But I think showing that you considered, you know, different approaches to the problem, both from a like structural product-y UX kind of perspective, as well as a like UI and visual design perspective. And I think that's quite important and often missing. Yeah, and beyond that, I think doing qualitative, like doing user testing or usability testing to figure out if the thing you designed actually makes sense to people and seeing those iterations, I think that's meaningful. This is often a place where I think people get lost, right? You maybe did 6 iterations of research and you want to show every single iteration, but that's probably too much. But showing, you know, we did some research where we saw that people couldn't understand this element of the UI, and therefore we changed it in this way. And then when we tested it, we saw, yes, they understood it better. That kind of thing is what I'm looking for, so that I know you aren't just checking the boxes, that you're really thinking about each step. And then the other thing I often see missing is thinking about interactions. Like, did you prototype something or do motion design around something to show feedback to users? If you did, it's worth having a GIF in there so someone can see what that looks like, or a link to a prototype if you want to do that, that kind of thing. And then I think conclusions are, you know, maybe talking about the implementation, if there were technical challenges you tackled. Again, like one example is good rather than the whole comprehensive list. And thinking about what the impact was. So I think mentioning if there are metrics that you can share about the impact, whether they are true metrics or whether they're signals, you know, X% decrease in customer support calls, or, you know, in our customer survey, an increase in the number of people who said they were very happy with our product, whatever that kind of thing is, it's worth mentioning. And lastly, I think if there's anything about what you did in that project that you would change, if you felt like, you know, I did this project, now that I'm done it, I've learned everything, and gee, I would have done it differently, that is helpful to mention as well, because I think, you know, a project is just a project, but showing that you kind of learn and grow from that is really meaningful.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for how you answered that question as well, Rachel. Very thorough and in depth, and I'm sure Matteo got a lot out of that answer. And yeah, because I know when I spoke to Libna, internal recruiter at Designit, and she said some similar things. And I think a lot of it as well is about editing. So although Matteo mentioned he's involved in every aspect of a project, you don't want to put absolutely everything in there. You want to edit your project and what you show and why that's relevant and why you put that in. And that's down to the individual. But Yeah, well, I'm going to wrap up the session and let you go. But again, thank you so, so much for your time and answering all my questions. And there's just so much there for everyone to take away. And I hope you all enjoyed the session today.
Thanks so much, Nikki. I really appreciate it. Thank you for organizing. Thank you for all your really thoughtful questions. I really appreciate it. And yeah, thank you everyone for joining. If you have any questions you want to ask that you didn't get the chance to, you can tweet at me at RILAN. And I'll see you on the internet, I suppose.